This is an ABC podcast.
There is no other alternative for a Prime Minister than the rule of law.
To Scott Morrison, stop dealing with this as a political problem and start doing the right thing.
Not so much a tin ear as a wall of concrete.
Having children doesn't guarantee a conscience.
Women who have put up with this rubbish and this crap for their entire lives.
I've had a gutful. I have had an absolute gutful.
Welcome to the party room. I'm Patricia Carvelis from RN Drive and Afternoon Briefing.
And I'm Fran Kelly from RN Breakfast. And we are in the same place.
I know. We are actually eyeballing each other, staring each other down.
I have not seen you in the flesh for more than a year. It's incredible. It's almost too much for me. Soon we're going to be joined also in the flesh by Laura Tingle, 7:30's chief political correspondent, to talk about Christine Holgate. If you've been hiding under a rock or something, you might not know Christine Holgate. She's the former CEO of Australia Post. She broke a silence this week, told a Senate inquiry that she felt humiliated, bullied and pushed out of her job at Australia Post over the Cartier watches affair. And she was demanding an apology from the Prime Minister for publicly calling on her to go. The Prime Minister, though, was not for turning.
What I stated in the Parliament was, if the Chief Executive, and the indication had been that this might be the case, was not prepared to stand aside, and then that she might wish to leave the company. Now, I reflected that in the Parliament. Now, it was a willing day in the Parliament. The language in the Parliament was very strong. It was not my intention to cause distress to Christine Holgate, and I regret any distress that strong language may have caused to her, indeed did cause to her. That was not my intention.
So regret, distress, but no apology. And we're going to get into
sorry this. You felt that way.
Yeah, sorry you felt that way. I'm sorry if you felt that I did that to you. We're going to get into this with Laura a little later because she interviewed Christine Holgate on 7:30 the night of that Senate inquiry. But PK, it was a big week this week for the Prime Minister on another front too, and for the nation really. The Prime Minister called for reinforcements and has enlisted the states and territories to get the national vaccine rollout back on track. He's announced National Cabinet will now meet twice a week. We haven't done that since way back at the start of the lockdown. And that's going to happen for the foreseeable future. The states were always involved in the vaccination program. Of course, they had to be involved vaccinating their quarantine workers, their frontline workers. But the Commonwealth was really running the show. And under their guidance, the vaccine rollout went way behind schedule. GPs have been calling out for supply, saying that people can't get a GP appointment. The aged care and the disability care sector say, well, they haven't even come to us yet and we're supposed to be the priority. So this call from the Prime Minister, I think it's an acknowledgement that the Commonwealth needs help. The states have been offering. They're the ones who are really good at service delivery. They do it all the time. And the New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian has been saying for weeks now, basically, just give us the doses, we'll do it.
Yeah, we'll do it. And we know based on history that the states are better at doing this. So in fact, I see it as a bungle from the beginning, the whole execution of this. Yes, there's the issue of supply and, you know, having meetings twice a week isn't going to fundamentally change that unless you can really rearrange all of that system and trying to get more supply into the country. But the government took too long to agree to these mass vaccination hubs. Now the Prime Minister has said yes, and in fact that's going to be the strategy by the end of the year, these mass vaccination hubs, when the last part of the AstraZeneca supply comes in.
So that's going to be like football stadiums or convention centres and things like that.
Yeah, and done really quickly, right? But you know, it all goes back, obviously, to the AstraZeneca decision. That was a huge blow when the government accepted the health advice that it should not be given to people under 50. That was obviously going further than the UK advice. You know, ironically, our success is why we went further, because we do have low transmission. So it's a cost-benefit analysis. Why would you take a higher risk when you don't have the virus sort of going through and ripping through your community? Now, the countries that are doing their vaccination well, again, are the countries that have been hit by coronavirus so badly. I'm actually not that surprised by that. It's been considered quite surprising by people because they've failed on the other fronts. Makes sense to me that you'd kind of make sure that your vaccination program was working when people were dying in high numbers. In Australia, I think that there has been a sense of complacency. I'm not justifying. I think it's been the wrong way to go forward. But that sense of urgency hasn't been there. And that has led, I think, to the problems we've seen. Now, I think taking this long to announce having two meetings a week is a bit strange. I don't know why this didn't happen at the beginning.
I know why.
It's because, a no-brainer, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think because the Prime Minister thought they could do this and they would get a lot of kudos for this. Remember, this might have been an election year. Mm. And the Prime Minister, there was a lot of talk about the fact that this would be, you know, we'd get the whole nation vaccinated and we'd go to the polls. Then that kind of didn't work because the vaccination program, even when things were going smoothly, wasn't going to happen in time. But the Prime Minister, at the beginning of this year, his first speech said, this is my number one priority, to roll out this vaccination. In fact, he was criticised by many for not having much of an agenda except rolling the vaccine out. And look how it's gone. I mean, there's talk now of we're on a war footing. You know, if we're on a war footing, the Commonwealth look like Dad's army, to be
frank.
Yeah,
yeah, it doesn't look like a great war strategy, does it?
Well, it doesn't look like a great fighting unit either. Yeah. You know, there's a metaphor they use or saying they have in the army, which is it goes to the five Ps: prior preparation prevents poor performance, or some of them say piss poor performance, add another P in there for good measure. And the prior planning, I think, is what's gone awry here. We had time to plan. We built that in. We didn't need to rush because we didn't have community transmission. Much was made from that. We're going to look at the mistakes made overseas. We're going to get it right here. And what's happened? They haven't got it right. Things aren't being delivered to the aged care homes. They're not being delivered to the disability
sector. And if you look
at
the way it's been handled, right, now there's this, we're recording this Thursday morning, late in the week pivot to the war footing, to the cabinet meetings, to the sending Dan Tehan, the minister, off overseas.
Dispatching
Dan Tehan. He's dispatched to try and work out, you know, that our pipeline is secure, that we're going to get these Pfizer doses. But if you look at the way it was handled earlier in the week, it again was a bungle. The Prime Minister announcing on Facebook that he was going to abandon the targets.
No targets, no timeline.
Huge backlash to that. So now we're recording on a Thursday morning. There's been this pivot where he says, yeah, he hopes that by the end of the year, everyone gets their dose. So he's actually strengthened the language again. Not quite a commitment, but trying to say we're going to try and do it. Because saying there's we can't give you a timeline was politically, I think, really problematic.
Yeah, but it goes to the other point, because there's been criticism of the Prime Minister or the government, really, of over-promising and under-delivering. And the promise was we're going to get it all done. Everyone's going to have their jab by October. Then it was the first jab by October. Now it's the end of the year. Then it was no timeline. Now it's hopefully the end of the year. The government points out you can't be precise. We're in a pandemic. Fair enough. We've had supply hiccups. We didn't know that the Europeans were going to say, no, you can't send that Pfizer to Australia. We need it here. We didn't know that. We didn't know AstraZeneca was going to get revised down to be not so safe for people under 50s.
We did get a hint.
Well, and experts looking on go, you can factor these things in and you should factor these things in. Labor was saying from the middle of last year, we're too slow in getting our vaccine orders in. Other countries have got deals with four or five or even six suppliers. We don't have any yet. That was July. We got our deals done by, I think, November, but only really with AstraZeneca, Pfizer, and then for Moderna later in the year. You know, people were worried that wasn't enough. We didn't have insurance enough. So for the government to say, well, right, we've got a supply problem. That's true. But part of that goes back to the five Ps: prior planning, prevents piss poor performance.
And of course, I think it's a welcome change to see them working together in a more coordinated way for the states to play a bigger role for mass vaccination sites. I do think that's a good idea. But you've got to wonder whether this is all about spreading the political responsibility too, right? Whether this is like shoving the blame, because this doesn't look like it's going to work out quite as well as you thought it would.
Yeah, originally, the Commonwealth was going to manage it. Yeah. Well, now we're all in charge.
Yeah, yeah, everyone's in charge. And when everyone's in charge, Fran, what happens?
The blame is spread around.
Correct. Or there's just a blame game. Should we bring in our guest?
I reckon we should.
Laura Tingle, 7:30's Chief Political Correspondent. And this week it's presented to friend of the podcast, welcome to the Party Room.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I just had to get the straw out of my mouth from my martini.
Because not only is Laura a friend of the Party Room, she's a party animal.
Yeah.
So, like, it's always...
Fran, party animals are a bit sort of, you know, not correct these days.
Oh,
just saying.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Burning the candle at both ends. Yeah. That's what she's doing.
That's what she does.
We're not in Parliament House, so it's okay to be a party animal.
Let's talk about Christine Holgate, because the comments from her, this all started, the whole affair actually started, Laura, at a Senate inquiry last October, when Labor suddenly started asking questions about cardio watches being handed out to Australia Post executives. The Prime Minister heard about this later in the day, was outraged. He vented with a very strong, very personally directed message in the Parliament to Christine Holgate that most people listening heard it as she should quit. That's how a lot of us heard it, I think. An investigation was held. She was later cleared of any wrongdoing, but she'd already stood aside. And this week she chose that same Senate committee, I think it was, to make her feelings known.
I was humiliated and driven to despair. I was thrown under the bus so the chairman of Australia Post could curry favour with his political masters. But I'm still here, and I'm stronger for surviving it.
Bullied and humiliated. Laura, two words the Prime Minister's been fending off a lot lately from women.
Mm.
And but she wasn't supposed to take offence at that, Fran.
No, no offence was intended. Mm. You interviewed her that evening after she'd been before the Senate inquiry. She told you very clearly she believed the PM attacked her. The attack was gender-based, that the fact she was a woman was a part of the tone of that attack, if not the attack itself. The Prime Minister himself said gender had nothing to do with it. What do you think? And what did you think at the time, actually?
Can we go back a couple of steps? Is that all right? Just to be sure. You know, I'll do that politician thing of saying...
I'll answer the question I want to answer.
Yeah. No, but I just sort of think it's important because they've skated through under all the noise about this, but this was basically a Labor attack.
You know, yes.
Labor went for this woman. You know, there's all sorts of skullduggery going on in Australia Post, which I'm presuming that some of the unions didn't like. So they went for her. And Anthony Albanese asked a very pointed question, which provoked that response from Scott Morrison, which was, how in the midst of this terrible recession could this be happening? So just want to put that on the record. Without a doubt, though, before we get to gender, the response was, as I said, you know, on the needles in the strawberries category scale. You know, it was just beyond belief in the circumstances that we're facing that he went so feral over this, you know, bad look.
Which, so, in fact, didn't happen during the pandemic. It happened
two years ago. Yeah, exactly. So it was sort of, once again, he hadn't done his homework on it. And as she said to me, and as I think she said in the Senate inquiry, nobody actually rang up and said, what was this about? You know, what was this deal about? It was saving 3,000 small businesses. Gee, wait a minute.
We're the Liberal Party.
That's really good. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So nobody asked her. They just went for it. And I don't know the extent to which it was initially gender-based. I think there's this sort of secondary question that comes out about the extent to which, as she says, she was unpopular because she opposed this Boston Consulting Group report, which looks like it was basically being set up to further privatise Australia Post. But without a doubt, you know, you look at the way she was treated and the way blokes are treated.
It's all by comparison. That's where the gender analysis
is. And it's all through the current lens, which we're operating in now.
Absolutely, which would make you would think, you know, doubly careful about what you were saying about any of this stuff. But without a doubt, his language was just unbelievable, you know, to be attacking somebody who is one of the senior Australian female business figures like that. It was just, in the Parliament, it was, I just think, extraordinary.
I remember at the time, I thought giving Cartier watches was not appropriate. I thought,
that's
a terrible look. We shouldn't be doing that. But I was talking to Helen Haynes on breakfast. Mm. She's the independent member for Indi. And she said that she remembers at the time in the Parliament being really shocked by the Prime Minister's tone. She hadn't heard that tone from him before. She left question time and went out to find out the circumstances of what had gone on because she was so surprised and I think a bit distressed by the Prime Minister's tone. So there was definitely a vibe there that people thought his tone was over-the-top reaction, even if giving Cartier watches to Australia Post executives
was not okay. That's right. And not only that, now the defence is, which I think is so extraordinary, the Labor Party made us do it.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
What?
well, they did.
Wait, they also asked you to make Christian Porter, a backbencher. They also asked you to get rid... You didn't do those things.
No, they didn't. And he gets himself into these terrible knots, doesn't he? Like sort of saying, well, you know, I didn't mean to cause her any offence or upset. I mean... Really, sorry. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, at the same time, I'm pretty sure that the Prime Minister at various stages has said, you know, there are a lot of people hurting here, you know, about ministers who have been in trouble, you know, and that families have been broken up and, you know, so therefore we've got to be careful about what we say about the fact that
people are under pressure.
People are under pressure. Yeah, sorry.
Didn't matter for her.
And no. Also, and I think this came out in your interview particularly, but none of these politicians seem to ever ring up people and speak privately to them and say, hey, are you okay? She knew many of these ministers. She worked closely for the nation with some of these ministers. And I think she said to you, still to this day, she hasn't had phone calls. I'm not sure if that's correct.
I think the one exception really was, I mean, she had, I think, some business-like communications with Paul Fletcher, but she co-chairs the trade board with Simon Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And he did speak to her and he spoke to her for about 45 minutes and she was sort of grateful for that.
Yes.
But eventually, he said, well, you've got to send it to Fletcher because he's the minister, what you're going to say.
Oh, that's
and that
right.
Stuff.
He said, we'll see what we can do or
something. You know, and then, you know, your
Radio
people
silence.
Will call my people and all that stuff. But I think the other thing that was extraordinary and really fascinating out of that was nobody from the board supported her other than Tony Nutt. And you guys both know.
And let's
know
say
that
who Tony Nutt is.
Yeah,
Tony Nutt
from the past.
Was, of course, a Liberal Party federal director. But more importantly, he was the fix-it guy for John Howard for years. Like when there were problems like people harassing people on Facebook or whatever, he was the guy who went round and banged heads together. Now, I think it's really fascinating that he was the guy who made 14 phone calls to Christine Holgate in the wake of that Senate inquiry hearing about the watches, and she says was trying to support her. Meanwhile, Australia Post is cutting off her emails, won't give her phone records. There's one woman from Australia Post, Sue Davies, who was helping her, and a couple of others who were doing their best. But the board just cut her absolutely adrift. And I thought one of the other really devastating parts of that Senate inquiry was her going through the list of who's on the Australia Post board. Mm. And what their connections are with the government.
Mm-hmm. And that's and
to
that's
the Liberal
the
Party in particular.
Yeah. At the centre of this is the claim that the Prime Minister's comments in Parliament meant that basically it was a sacking. She resigned, right, officially, but because she was basically told her position's untenable because of his commentary. That's what she
Let's just remind people what he said. He said she should stand aside. If she doesn't, she must go.
Well, the thing is, it was quite a long answer, and that's the colourful bit that keeps getting played. But if you actually look or listen to what he says,
that's why
in
we
full,
get Laura here for context.
What he actually says is he's boasting and claiming responsibility for this. He says, as soon as I heard this, I was appalled. This was disgraceful. Yeah. I rang the shareholder ministers and several steps were taken immediately, including that she should stand aside, right? Now, they're now saying, oh, well, we only wanted her to stand aside. Well, sorry, they were talking stood down.
It was a pasting.
It was a pasting. He sort of directed that. She clearly understood that that was the instruction that was being passed down by the chairman, who didn't actually really tell her directly that. And so he was, you know, on the day, he was taking credit for, you know, acting
so decisively.
He was being a strong
decisively.
Man. He was being a strong man. Yeah. I'm acting decisive about this. This is not on Cartier watches.
She felt
watches.
Like her position was untenable, which is why she resigned.
Yeah. And she said to me in the interview, she said, look, it's just ludicrous to say that you can stand aside from a multi-billion dollar corporation and then come back, particularly at Christmas time if it's Australia Post. Yeah. But she said that the whole organisation's confidence was shattered by that vote of no confidence in me
her.
And in what we had done.
And there was a comparison the very next day. I think it was the very next day when it was revealed that the head of ASIC had been been paid all this money for, I think, getting his tax affairs in order because they'd wooed him from overseas.
Looked like
too
a
much
good deal.
Money. Tens and tens and tens and thousands of dollars, much more than anyone ever anticipated it would be. It was not appropriate, the Auditor General found. And there was not this kind of extreme hysterical calls for, you know, I'm going to ring him up and I'm going to tell him what's what, was there?
Well,
James
there wasn't.
Shipton.
And there certainly wasn't with the NBN bonuses, which also emerged subsequently. And I think, you know, beyond the issues of just her appalling treatment, there is this really interesting question about, look, the Liberal Party has privatised lots of organisations, it's corporatised lots of organisations, and the whole idea of that is that you make them independent of government and accountable for their own actions. And so the Prime Minister sort of getting up on his high horse yesterday and saying, the real issue for me was that she'd said that it wasn't taxpayer money. Well, one of those things is it taxpayer money or not? The watches came out of money. She was allocated to be able to give, she was able to give these people bonuses of $150,000. That was within her remit. But they came out of the Australia Post balance sheet, which is now a separate entity to the federal government. And one of the reasons why that deal behind the Cartier watches was so important was because the federal government has starved, as it has of quite a few corporations we could mention, of money, and it needed to get a private sector capital injection in to keep banks in 55% of the rural communities in Australia who would have lost them otherwise.
I think that most people think Australia Post is taxpayers' money. They think we own
and
it.
And that's why the government is now... The Prime Minister's language I actually thought was quite clever around this. I'm sorry for how she feels. Well, no, sorry, not the S word. He regrets how she feels. But then talking about public money and Australia Post being... That's what he wants us to think, though that's not the fact.
And she now acknowledges it was a bad look.
It was bad language. You know, it was bad language, like Cartier watches was a bad look. But they have made her responsible for how taxpayers' money is spent and given her the authority to do that. So, you know, I just think they can't have it both ways.
No. All right, let's move to the other huge issue, which affects every Australian, of course. We were talking about vaccines earlier, Laura. The government did not want this distraction this week. The polls are showing people are losing confidence in their vaccine rollout, and that's not surprising. What rollout? Can you get the jab? I know.
Stumble out?
Yeah, no, it's not really happening. This is Scott Morrison's self-declared, as Fran was saying a little earlier, number one priority of the year. The New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian, she has been really critical of the government throughout the week. Here she is.
There'll become a point when the rest of the world starts engaging with each other more, and we can't afford to be left behind. We want our citizens to be safe. So I'm really keen to get the rollout happening as fast as we can. I do have a sense of urgency about it.
Sense of urgency. Now, that comment came right after the Prime Minister on Facebook walked away from the targets. The targets aren't officially back, but now he wants mass vaccination hubs to try and get people, you know, with the jab by the end of the year. What went wrong?
With the whole thing?
Yeah.
Look, what is underlying all of this? What have we learnt through the pandemic? That the federal government cannot do service delivery. How are they getting jabs out to nursing homes? They're doing it via contracting out. Otherwise, they're doing it through the GP network. Why is that? Partly because they don't probably have other infrastructure, and partly because they were lobbied by the AMA. That is the reality of it. The whole thing is, once again, it's the announcement versus the delivery. I was told by a very reliable source that Greg Hunt was told not to announce the 1B rollout, which was to people who weren't frontline workers and stuff, who people over 70, until the GP network had been informed what was going to go on. He ignored that advice, went ahead with the announcement because, you know, he likes to have announcements. And suddenly the GPs come in on the Monday morning. Their systems have all
crashed.
Their
phones are going nuts.
Yeah. Half of them have worked out that logistically they can't do this, or the others who did want to do it haven't had their fridges arrive, or they don't have the extra staff yet.
Well, they've got three doses. So.
You look at those daily figures. Yeah. I mean, in Canberra, for example, and I think it's probably the case around the rest of the country, they're getting 40 or 50 doses a week. Now, okay, it might accelerate, but remember all those tours of the CSL laboratory? I kept asking people yesterday. I said, is there some problem with this that we haven't heard of?
I read this week that 800,000 doses are being prepared, are being actually produced by CSL at the moment, or within a week will be. I mean, that's a lot. Where are they? Yeah. We also heard this week, and I think this is shameful, that in disability residences, there's hundreds and hundreds of them who have not heard anything. They're the first priority. They're that 1A priority rollout, and they haven't heard a thing. So where are all these doses?
Well, and I mean, there are all sorts of questions. One of them is, and we had a couple of epidemiologists on 7:30 last night, and their point was, one of their points was, they shouldn't have actually been worried so much about giving, the old people the shots. The risk to the old people was from the workforce.
Yeah.
And they should have been giving them the shots. Yeah. But that wasn't happening. Now, and I find, you know, they keep throwing around all these figures. Like, for example, they keep saying, oh, well, we've given, I think it was the last look, about 150,000 shots in aged care, brackets, asterisk, about 50,000 of them are second shots. And we've covered about 500 establishments. Now, 100,000 people is about half the aged care residential population. So they've only done half of them. And there are about 3,000 residential aged care facilities, and they've only done 500. So you know, debacle.
So what do they do now? Because confidence is key. We all know that for a vaccination rollout. There's enough vaccination denial that goes on to anyway threaten a program, let alone if confidence GPs are saying they've had people ring up and cancel since the AstraZeneca hurdle became public. So what do they do now? There's calls for them to be daily announcing vaccine numbers. Or what does the government need to do?
Well, they have started to do that, but I've got to say that only sort of reinforces how few, I think, have really been done.
But it's good to have the transparency, to be fair, just
that
to know.
Much transparency, but they actually don't tell you very much. They don't tell you how much Pfizer, they don't tell you how much AstraZeneca, they don't tell you, they really don't give you an age profile or whatever.
They pick and choose for a big number.
Yeah, so once again, our epidemiologists last night were saying that actually it's not useful data. I don't know how they actually restore confidence in the vaccines themselves. Their main problem now is the supply thing, which is why I think it is really interesting that the CSL thing seems to have gone so quiet. Maybe it's ramping up, we just haven't heard about it.
Hope so.
But I think they'll have to basically surrender, get the states to run mass vaccination centres. I think, particularly as the because GPs won't be able to deal with the load, particularly with flu vaccines coming up as well. Mm. I think people will at some point just go, well, they'll make their own calls, but they'll say, look, I do want to go overseas, or I do want to get this job, and it'll be a bit like climate change, you know, where the market basically makes people go, I think it's worth my while taking the risk.
And I think it's important to say it is worth the while. I mean, it is going to be a good idea to be vaccinated. Mm. And by and large, if you speak to most medical experts, they say the vaccines are safe. Mm. And we need to get that message out, but it's just been clouded.
And particularly for older people, if you think about it, particularly ones who are sort of website challenged, you know, and you've got to book things online. You know, they're just going to give up and go away if they're trying to get – and they, you know, they go to their GP says, oh, no, we don't do it, but you can try somebody else. They go to the other practice and the other practice says, well, you're not one of our patients, so rack off. Mm. Those are the sorts of holes that they've really got to fill.
Yeah, and you look at, just one last comment, just the way that at the beginning of the crisis, you know, there were the fever clinics and all of this rolled out. It is just astonishing that we didn't take a similar kind of – big bang approach to this.
Well, of course, they were run by the states, just saying, PK.
Well, that's the thing. And now we've gone back to that model and it's, you know, it speaks volumes really about what the Prime Minister realised and the heat he was clearly under. Now, we're recording this podcast on a Thursday morning like we do. We always tell you that. Today, Laura, as it turns out, it marks 30 years to the day since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody on April the 15th, 1991. Of those 339 recommendations, very few have been acted on. It's been pointed out that I think it's over 60% have been acted on. But if you listen to the groups that matter, that scrutinise this, they say meaningful and full implementation hasn't happened. So that's the important caveat there. More than 450 Indigenous Australians have died in custody in the past 30 years, including 5 since the beginning of March this year. So it's quite real and it's happening now. The Prime Minister has been under pressure to meet with the families who are grieving. I want to mention this comparison because I think it speaks to the powerlessness of Aboriginal people in this country. When women were marching, and they still will, but when that big march happened, March for Justice, and there was this discussion, the Prime Minister offered those women a private meeting. They wanted him to come out, whatever, it's irrelevant. These people are very happy for a private meeting. They say, we don't have the luxury of asking for it publicly. We just want to get in front of this guy. Mm. It hasn't, as we record, it might be later, I'm not sure, but right now, no meeting. Why has the federal government kind of gone, it's just the state's issue. There's been a real lack of responsibility, hasn't there,
I think there's a generational thing here. You know, Fran, you were interviewing people about this morning, and we did a piece on it last night as well. But you know, Patrick Dodson, for example, he is a bit of a consistent figure in all of this time. But you think about all the generations of police, all the generations of state politicians, and particularly all the generations of federal politicians who have got no recollection of the days when Indigenous issues were actually regarded as something important for the federal government to look at, that it needed to take ownership of the issue, that it needed to push the states on things. Now, the sorts of issues that they're talking about, the age of criminality, you know, being raised and all those sorts of things, you need, dare one say, national leadership. And there is absolutely, if anything, we've gone so sort of significantly backwards on Indigenous affairs actually being taken seriously, you know, from the symbolic, you know, to the, from the fact that instead of just doing the welcome to country, we do the cheerio to defence veterans, you know, to the really significant issues, they just don't want to know about it because they've none of them have ever been engaged in it. I mean, somebody made the observation that one of the problems for John Howard was that, as Prime Minister, was that when he'd been in opposition, when he'd been in government, he had never actually engaged in the Indigenous affairs debates. And I think that's the problem for all of these guys. They've never actually had to sit down and think about it.
But still, the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken White,
is Indigenous.
He's Indigenous. He is. And he's quietly working on some of these issues.
And he's also been quietly sidelined, yeah. I think you'd have to observe.
That's,
you know,
absolutely.
He gave a speech at the press club and within, you know, half an hour of him finishing, yep. He was being backgrounded against, oh, well, that's never going to happen.
Yep.
Yeah, but at the same time, we've invited him on the program all week to mark this important week, and he did not agree to an interview.
No, he spoke to 7:30, though. But either way, there has been... And it's a, and I know some of the sort of key figures in Indigenous affairs, Noel Pearson, Marcy Langton, Megan Davis, there's many others, have been frustrated at this kind of, hang on a minute, what's happening at that level? And if you look at the Constitution, remember 1967?
Yeah, it was all about that.
It's the Commonwealth's job.
It's sort of like quarantine's the Commonwealth's job, but, you know, yeah. Whatever.
It's incredibly frustrating. Yeah. I just want to end on the point you made about the age of criminal responsibility. This is a can that's been kicked down the road. The Attorney General's met, all of them, last year. Now the Attorney General has changed. It's been a meeting this year. They haven't agreed to it. 10-year-olds are held criminally responsible in this country, right? That is not the international standard best practice.
And that's 10-year-olds. That's gone backwards from the time of the Royal Commission, right?
It's disgraceful. Like, I have a 9-year-old. I love her, but she should never be held responsible for anything.
Because,
right?
Because let's say what that means, PK. That means, okay, they're not putting 10-year-olds in adult prisons, but they are putting 12-year-olds because it's legal under the law. I'm not saying they're adult prisons, but they're locking kids up from the age of 12. Kids from the age of 10 are getting a record, which means at that early age, they're being propelled into that criminal justice system, into that penal, you know.
But no one contests this. As soon as you interact with that system, you are largely in it forever.
Gone. You're gone. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, this is a no-brainer. You'd think they'd be able to do that alone, let alone all the other
But it's a no-brainer. They had the Royal Commission into the Don Dale Inquiry. They found that no child there under the age of 14 should be locked up, but they still haven't made that the law. Mm. They still haven't changed that.
Mm. Gone backwards. Depressing. Well, it doesn't really cover it, does it, anyway?
Shameful,
on that
probably does.
Very somber note, we can't pretend anything's upbeat, but we can say goodbye to you.
Yeah. Well, yes, goodbye. We got through all of that depressing news, so nice to see you both.
Great to see you again, Laura.
See ya.
Bye.
Questions without notice. The Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, and I'm pleased the question time at least is happening, Mr. Speaker. Yeah!
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. Parliament's not sitting, actually, but...
We've got question time anyway because we're constant. We never put down the tools. PK, this week's question comes from Diane, who writes, do you think the way politicians speak to each other in the House will ever change? Why do they have to be so rude to each other during question time?
Look, I don't think it's going to change in my lifetime. I think lots of things could change in the faraway future, like look at the world today compared to 200 years ago. But no, the culture of that place is a really, it's really masculine and pumped up, and there's a lot of, what did the Prime Minister call it this week when he was referring to his strong
willing?
Language? Willing. It's a willing place. So I don't think it's going to change. I actually do think it's, I don't mean to sound too sort of like choir girl or something, but it is a bit rude. It is rude. I don't mind a bit of robust pop political discourse, but I find it sometimes mean and I don't like mean.
No, well, often what's mean, if you get to sit in the gallery, if you're down in Canberra and you're at Parliament House, you can hear some really mean things. Like I was shocked when I heard someone many years ago yell out to Jenny Macklin, who was the Shadow Health Minister, "Where's your broom? Go get your broom." In other words, you know, you're a witch. Things have got much worse since then. I'm a little bit more Pollyanna in the fact I think things can change and will change when there is a greater percentage of women in the parliament, because mostly it's not the women doing the really nasty sledging. That's not to say women are perfect, and this is an adversarial system we have. I covered politics. I was the Europe correspondent for a while, so I used to go and pay attention to question time in the British Parliament. It's much more polite, but I found it more boring myself. Mm. I like something about the adversarial system we have. We have a two-party system, but I think it's gotten much worse and it needs to come back.
Surely you can be robust, interesting, passionate.
Interesting would be good. Dorothy Dix's are just like a dead hand on Australian political debate. It's a waste of space.
Mean, cruel, sledging, personal,
I think
misogynistic. So. It wouldn't be that hard. Anyway, I'm not as hopeful as you, but maybe that's just, it's been a tough year. There's nothing more delightful than coming back after a holiday. I mean, we were off just for last week and having an inbox full of your questions. So keep sending them in. You can tweet us using the hashtag ThePartyRoom. You can email your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And you can follow us, of course, The Party Room on the ABC Listen app or your favourite podcast app, wherever that is. Rate, review, all of that. We love to know you're there and you're listening, and tell others about it too.
Do it. Well, that's it for The Party Room this week. How exciting to be in person with you, Fran.
It makes all the difference. I'm loving it. See you, PK.
See you, Fran.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.